Quite frequently, Clifford Odets is described as a playwright whose primary concern has been to provide a manner of stimulus for social reform through the American theater. I suppose one should say that on occasion this has taken the form of excited accusation. Perhaps there is basis for this. Clifford Odets would like to see a man say what he thinks, to say how he sees life, how he sees the world. For him, there is the unquestioned right of the individual for maximum fulfillment, and for him, there are ingredients in our contemporary culture which keep this from happening. So it is that he speaks as a critic of what there is around him, but Clifford Odets is not the less critical of what he sees within himself, and his protest is not the less severe nor demanding. When we met, we spoke of this, and I asked him what he would write if at this time he wanted to communicate what had come to represent his primary value investments, what he would say as a human being who had lived in and sensed a world about him, what there was that, after all had been said and done, had proved to be substantial and real and meaningful, what he saw as unquestioned and irreversible commitments.
I would want to talk, in our country particularly, about the fulfillment of each individual human being. I would want to make a statement as definitive as I was able, let me say, at the age of 75, knock on wood. I would like to make a statement about what in our American world develops all of the inherent possibilities of each man and woman, and what holds them back, what stymies them. Concomitantly with that, I would like to make a statement in the same work about innocence versus experience. I have the play picked out, I have the materials picked out, and I don't think it's a play that I will write until I am really 10 or 15 years older. I find our American world today, I find it lacks innocence. I find it lacks the conviction of innocence. I find that as quickly as we can, we are taught, we pick up from the air, we pick it up from the movies, from the magazines. We pick up those techniques in which we are richest. And those are the techniques of conciliation and ingratiation, the techniques of selling yourself, of getting across, of which necessarily means that innocence goes and experience perhaps shrivels our souls. I would include in a final statement in a play a need and a feeling for human sympathy, as I once said. But human sympathy and cooperation always within a context of personal integrity. Leaving out our American world, I think that men and women, particularly men, since women have never had their rightful place in the past, that men have always had to fight for personal integrity and have always had to fight for what I would call humanistic and sympathetic cooperation. Does what I'm saying make sense?
Yes. I'm concerned with one aspect here, your use of the term innocence. It has come to mean so many things, and I think so frequently, it becomes one peculiar manner of synonym for ignorance. This isn't the way you mean it, I know. What is this quality of innocence?
By innocence, I mean that quality, that uncorrupted quality with which all children are born, what Emerson called uncorrupted behavior. He ended by saying that only animals and children seem to have it. So it is a problem in America as far back as Emerson, probably a statement he made, let's say, in 1850. That quality of uncorrupted behavior, when nothing outside of yourself influences you, when you are in command of yourself, with honor, without dishonesty, without lie, when you grasp and deal and are permitted to deal with exactly what's in front of you in terms of your best human instincts. This is rather what I mean by innocence. I don't mean the innocence, although it is connected, the innocence of a Blake, who, as Mrs. Blake said, I seldom have his company because Mr. Blake is so much with heaven. I don't quite mean that. Sure, we have to, as we grow older, there are so many real techniques we have to learn out of reality testing. We must learn to live in communities. We certainly must be acculturated, housebroken, to put it more vulgarly, every child. There is, of course, the agony and a certain crippling and giving up that takes place with acculturation. With children, of course, as you know as well as I do, chiefly through the parents who have themselves been acculturated in one way or another. But I would like to see innocence and uncorrupted behavior kept. I would like a man to say what he thinks, not rudely. I would like him to say how he sees life, how he sees the world. I would fight to the death for him to have the right to say it. And I see it disappearing. I see the whole Jeffersonian ideal of what an American citizen should be disappearing.
The price is getting too great.
Oh, yes, yes. How many cases does a man's job depend upon it? Putting it again in let me say the parlance, you know, mind your business. Keep your nose clean. Keep your mouth shut. The best we get nowadays, for the most part, the best we get is living in the comfortable middle. That can be living on the uncomfortable fence, too. And we're ready to jump by the way. It reminds me of a story about a school teacher who was called up before a local school board. And he wanted the job very badly. And they kind of looked him over, kind of sniffed him over. And they said, well, you're a good teacher? He said, yes. They said, well, suppose you tell us, Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones, wanting the job, listened very carefully. And they said, well, suppose you tell us, what about the world? Is it round or is it flat? And Mr. Jones said, well, gentlemen, I can teach it either way. There's too much of that in this country today.
The point you make is well taken. You make it about the school teacher. May I come back from the other way and say that I have seen it, I think, almost without end in the creative artist, in the novelist, in the playwright, the musician?
You certainly have.
What's happening there?
I don't know about the musician. The composer does not have the chances for awards and rewards. The awards and rewards in America are enormous. They do not and have never existed, except perhaps in the days of the Renaissance patron, they have never existed as they do today, but in those arts which are popular arts. So the serious composer who is not a popular artist is not liable to the rewards, financial and otherwise, of our creative people today. He therefore must stay fairly clean or fairly kosher, so to speak. But when it comes to someone in my field, where there is an enormous demand for that sort of material, the man corrupts very easily. The success in this country is a fantastic experience. Newspapers, magazines beat down your door. They want interviews. They want to give you publicity. They must be hep. They want to be in the know. They want to get the news first. So that the buildup works always. They want to have the hottest news story about you. They want to know all about your personal life. They want to present their readers with the fresh news. There gets to be a kind of whole bandwagon psychology. Everybody jumps on it. Mm-hmm. Photographers and whatnot, including TV now. The man goes on and reads about himself, and before you know it, if he does not try to retain being a simple, working, private citizen, but if he begins to believe or be beguiled for 1 hour by the public image that he has become, that man's on the way to... That's one reason that the man is on his way down.
There's another aspect here that frightens me, and it frightens me, I think, to a rather extreme degree. There are forces, and there are pressures, certainly, in all situations. And I always feel comfortable if I can look around and pick out the good guys and the bad guys, the heavily mustached people, and they're black, somehow in an affective sense. I know these are bad guys. The others stand for all the virtues, and we know what they are. But there's a very insidious quality in this where I think eventually, particularly the creative artist, doesn't even know when he's being dishonest. And I wanted to ask you, how do you know it when actually you come through with a piece of work? How do you know that you haven't tried in deliberate fashion to match the idiom that will bring forth the greatest acclaim, the greatest overall reward? It's nice to be liked and loved by a society.
That's a good question. It almost makes it necessary for me to immediately put in a disclaimer and say that I have never done that. I might not be telling the full truth, but I think I would answer that question by dividing the answer into two parts. For the first part, we are still a puritanic America. I'm a writer. I have been a writer for something like over 25 years. That means I'm a professional writer. I want to be a professional writer. But in this country, to make this first part only about my medium, I am an honorable writer and an honest writer because of what I call the puritanic ethic. I am a writer of integrity only as long as I stay in the American theater. The moment I come out to Hollywood to stay here for one picture or four pictures, it is considered generally that I have prostituted myself or my talents. Is that a strong word for TV? It has its meaning in this context.
It's an apt word for your feeling.
It's the word. Mm-hmm. There are pieces written about it in papers. There is gossip that goes on. Let me put it a different way. They say, well, Odets has sold out. He thought this man was a wonderful writer. Now we see he's sold out. They forget that I'm a technician. They forget that I'm a technician when I write plays on Broadway. They forget that I'm a technician when I write movies, or as I will do later this year, write a series of TV shows with Richard Boone. They will forget that I am also a technician. It is permitted to really a great artist like Mozart to write a piece of wedding music one day, an occasion piece. In fact, maybe a series of occasion pieces for 2-3 years. As for instance, Beethoven had a silent period of almost 8 years in which he wrote some cheap Scotch and Irish songs, settings for a company named Thompson in Edinburgh. He was a technician. When Mozart turns away from his occasion pieces that he writes for money, bringing his enormous skill to the work, he then sits down and makes a personal statement. There is no ethic involved, no puritanism. There's no contempt for the man because he writes occasion pieces. We are lucky, of course, that they are not all occasion pieces, and that some of his greatest pieces are written out of his own state of being. And that brings me to the second part of my answer to your question. I know that I am functioning at the peak of my talent when I don't construct or don't build a construction which will please, or which is primarily fashioned to please an audience. But I do know that when I sit down to express my own inner state of being, that I am working at my best, and whatever depth I have, that will be in that work. I, by the way, think that's the only way that one can be creative. That the creative writer, artist, composer, what you will, is creative only because his own inner state of being demands some kind of outward statement. He then has sufficient technique to, shall I say, gel, solidify, or express in his given medium that state of being. The state of being might be, you know, the world, something's wrong with the world, something rotten in Denmark, I don't feel well, or I'm lonely, or I feel that men should work together in harmony as teams, as the technicians are doing here in this studio at this moment. It feels to me that there's something in contemporary life that makes that very difficult. What is that? I'm not geared in. I'm not a cog of something larger than myself. I am not serving some purpose outside of myself. Whatever the state of being is, if it starts that way, instead of with some kind of gag, some kind of little story. I think I'll write a love story. This will please an audience. If it doesn't start that way, but starts from the state of being, then I, for myself, and I believe most other creative men and women, know that they are on the trail of something real. And something real, if imperfect, perhaps imperfect, structure-wise, something real will come out.
Your writing, then, is an act of growth for you, isn't it?
It's an act of growth, or what I referred to earlier, certainly not an original phrase, an act of becoming. The becoming is expressed in a play you've written. You say, oh, that's what's been bothering me for 2-3 years. That's what's hurt me. Your great artist is a kind of divine baby. He's wearing a diaper and he's screaming, and someone turns him over, or he turns himself and finds he's got a big safety pin stuck in his rump. And to say it in that light way, the making of the artwork is the discovery and the removing of that safety pin.
When you go back and see your other plays, then, in a sense, you have a psychological history of Clifford Odets unfolding for you?
I think so, yes. I don't always like it when I look back. I'm not always pleased, and I say, well, if I had it to do over again, I might change it this way. I think I was unfair. I think I was out of balance. But by and large, what you say is true. And it's, again, let me talk always of great artists. I talk so much about musicians because I like music more than I like really playwriting plays. We certainly have the spiritual and psychological history of a Beethoven in his 16 quartets and his 36 sonatas and his 9 symphonies. There it is. No secrets. That is, if the ear is perceptive, you know there are no secrets.
You use this technique to find yourself from time to time, as you must have need of?
I think maybe the one of the main impulses behind creativity and its functioning in terms of works is that act of locating yourself, finding yourself. I don't mean the American scare of every day looking for status. Who am I? Where am I? What am I doing? Gee, am I getting ahead? Where am I on the weekly chart? You know, book of the month club. They're going to have a book of the hour club, you know, and I better be a man of the hour, and I had better be competent and up here all the time. I don't mean that kind of status thing. But I mean finding where you are in terms of growth, in terms of maturation, quietly, without anxiety, although anxiety is awfully good, it frequently gives heat to work. Mm-hmm. It gives pressure.
You have to look within all the time. I think as you mention this, Clifford Odets' play comes out. There's a review written of it. An audience listens to it and applauds it more or less. And their reaction to the product is, in a sense, such a small part of the overall thing which is involved. In a way, there's this surplus value of the product for you that no one ever knows, do they?
Oh, I would think that a few perceptive men and women know it. They are a very small minority. As for the rest, they're looking for a good show. You know, you want a buck's worth. And it's a hard buck, and you've paid it, and you want a buck's worth. I don't call it very human. It's understandable. You've paid your dollar, or nowadays, your $5 or $6 to see a play, my God. You do want your money's worth. That doesn't help a creative person. It never did help an artist. What helps an artist is to look at his work, a play or two, a novel or two, a musical piece or two, a painting, a few paintings, see an exhibit, one or two or more, and decide for yourself, if I like that man, I like what that man says. That man says something that's very close to me. That man expresses something that I am not able to express. Therefore, I will commit myself to that man. I will make a commitment to him and what he stands for. I will wish him luck. I will wish for his fulfillment, for his success. I will do it by the moment I hear a new play of his is opened, the moment I hear he has an exhibition down in Mr. Cantor's gallery, I will run there to see it. If I have $100 with which to buy a small drawing, I will do that because that will help him. I will buy a ticket to his show in advance before I read what the critics say. I am committed to that man. That is the more human way to treat the writer, the artist, call him what you will. Mm-hmm. Yes or no?
Yes, yes. But essentially, you're looking for the kind of commitment on the part of the audience that you and I have just been talking about doesn't even exist in the artist.
The artist is a lonely, cut-off man. He is, however, coming into his own in the United States. A friend of mine, Lee Strasberg, said to me in a recent visit to New York, he said, you know, the artists in the American scene are now becoming sort of the new priests. They're looked up to in a strange new way. Nowadays, doors fly open, foundations open their coffers the moment they hear the word artist, artist. He says it's something new. It's not like when we founded the group theater and had to exist from hand to mouth, from play to play. He was talking way back in 1930 or 31. And the artist is taking a strange place in America today.